Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. Our guest this hour is a fascinating man. He's the author of The Second Arab Awakening and The Battle for Pluralism. And he is joining us today to talk about all that's happened in the Arab world for the last few years and what's happened in his native country. Marwan Mosher is our guest this hour, and let me tell you a little bit about him. He is now the Vice President for Studies at Carnegie, where he oversees research in Washington and Beirut on the Middle East. He served as Foreign Minister and Deputy Prime Minister of Jordan. He opened Jordan's first embassy in Israel in 1995. He became Minister of Information and the government spokesperson. From 97 to 2002, he served in Washington again as ambassador, negotiating the first free trade agreement between the U.S. and an Arab nation. He returned to Jordan to serve as Foreign Minister, where he played a central role in developing the Arab Peace Initiative. In 2004, he became Deputy Prime Minister, responsible for reform. He was a member of the Jordanian Senate, and he was also a Senior Vice President of External Affairs at the World Bank. He's also the author of The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation. He writes that the Arab world has long been dominated by two forces, an entrenched, unaccountable elite and Islamists, but neither of these groups has ever demonstrated a genuine commitment to pluralism. And he writes a great deal and very thoughtfully about pluralism. Third forces are needed. Hope rests, he says, with a new generation, the youth, who started it all in the streets. And so far, this revolutionary young generation has done a better job of defining what it is against than what it is for. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Marwan Mosher. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. We'd love to hear from you. Marwan Mosher, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You start in your book, early on in the book, I'm interested in the history here of the Arab world, if we can take it on in a few minutes. Beginning in the mid-19th century, you write, when the first Arab awakening took the form of an intellectual revolution. Can you refresh our minds the history of that, and if there's any parallel between what's happening now and what was happening in the mid-19th century?
This is a period in the history of the contemporary Arab world when intellectual members of society in several Arab countries, in Lebanon, Syria, Egypt, and elsewhere, began talking about the need for their societies to be exposed to the outside world, to be free of Ottoman rule and later on of colonial rule. These movements, uncoordinated, later found themselves into popular movements that started calling for independence of the Arab world from the Ottomans and then from colonial rule. Where the first Arab awakening, in my view, failed is that it has stopped at independence. Once independence was achieved, no Arab country has worked to put in place pluralistic democratic systems and institutions to ensure pluralistic societies. And so what I'm calling for in the book, The Second Arab Awakening, is a move not just to get rid of despotic rule, but also a move to build in democratic societies.
Mm-hmm. Why is it so hard? Why is it so hard to realize that somebody else may have another point of view?
Well, this is a region that has not known democracy for probably ever. This is also a region where several countries were artificially created by the British and French 100 years ago, in which people of different ethnic and religious backgrounds were put together without any sense of citizenship, of a national identity emerging in the 100 years that separate us from that agreement. Diversity in the Arab world, even though the Arab world is extremely diverse, ethnically and religiously, but diversity as a virtue has really not been taught in schools. And people were taught just to think alike, not to think critically, not to think outside the box, but to sort of channel all their energies toward one common good. And the result has been a stifling of society and a stifling of innovation.
Mm-hmm. You write about in Egypt, both the Islamists and the secular opposition were behaving in a majoritarian, winner-takes-all manner. Why did they go that direction? And is there a model of another country in the Middle East where this hasn't been the case? Winner-takes-all, instead we're looking at inclusion.
Absolutely. We have two very stark models, at least, of course, we have more than two models, but two very stark models that have emerged so far from the Arab uprisings that have taken place. One is the inclusive model of Tunisia, where all forces of society work together to write a constitution that would assure all forces of society a place in the system. Even though the process was troublesome, it ended in a constitution that upheld the right of all forces to a peaceful rotation of power, total parity between men and women, the right to believe or not to believe, etc. Probably the most forward-looking constitution that the Arab world ever knew. This is in contrast to Egypt's model, where all the forces in the country are behaving in a zero-sum game, in a winner-take-all strategy, as you said. When the Islamists were in power last year, they tried to push through a constitution that did not enjoy a consensus among all forces of society. And today, the secular forces, with the help of the military in Egypt, are behaving in exactly the same manner that they have accused the Islamists of doing last year. In other words, clinging to power and denying any other force the right to operate.
Mm-hmm. What about in Jordan, the country you're most familiar with, and you are responsible, the deputy prime minister responsible for reform and government performance? What kind of reform?
In Jordan, Jordan is one of the monarchies of the Arab world. Ironically, in the monarchies, we have not seen transitions, you know, both in the rich monarchies of the Gulf and in the poor monarchies of Jordan and Morocco. This is probably because the leaders and the systems in these countries actually enjoy more legitimacy than other countries of the Arab world. And that is why a reform from above process has the best chance of succeeding without having these countries go through the turmoil that Egypt, Tunisia, or Syria are going through. The challenge there is whether these governments are convinced that if they want to keep their power, they have to share it, and whether they move in a gradual but serious way to put in a system of checks and balances where the executive is less dominant, and where, such as exactly in this country, where you strengthen the judiciary, where you strengthen the legislative branch of government, so that no one force in government, dominates other forces. That is not, I think, being done satisfactorily yet. Both Jordan and Morocco did undergo certain reforms, but they have not amounted to a comprehensive reform process that would result, as I said, in power sharing. Mm-hmm. And in rich monarchies of the Arab world in the Gulf, what they have attempted to do, of course, is pour money on the problem, hoping that money would solve all issues. And certainly this has slowed down, I think, the process of reform in these countries, but I don't think it can do so indefinitely.
Mm. I was interested in an interview you did, I can't remember with whom, Mr. Marcher, and it was about education. And we all talk about education reform efforts and what's best for our children. But in the Arab world, your comments, I thought, were very striking, that current reform efforts have been focusing on quantity rather than quality, building more schools, et cetera, instead of what people are being taught, and that they're not being taught to think independently and critically. There is too much rote learning going on. Is that true across the board in many Arab nations?
Almost in all Arab nations.
Really?
Unfortunately, the rote learning method of education is dominant in the Arab world. And if the Arab world is to hope for a diverse and democratic society, a culture that really respects diversity, tolerates other points of view, accepts that society has differences, then the education system must be revisited. Not in terms of putting more people in school or in terms of, you know, introducing computers to schools, but in terms of the value systems. Are people taught to think critically? Are they taught that truths are relative and not absolute? Are they taught to accept and even celebrate different points of view, think critically, etc.? Unless these skills and values are taught at a very young age, it is very difficult for democracy to flourish. Booz Allen has a study, for example, that shows that if Saudi Arabia does everything right on education and puts in place a new educational system with all the attributes that I talked about, it is going to take 45 years for results to be seen.
Whoa!
So we, of course, we are, you know, there are no shortcuts to democracy. This is a generational evolution. And, you know, the later we start, the worse it becomes. Education, in my view, is one of the first areas that any transition, any country undergoing transition in the Arab world must look at because the results are not going to be seen quickly.
And when you say rote learning, can you give me an idea of what that means?
That means it's a system based on memory,
okay,
memorization of concepts rather than thinking. It means that you teach people what to think, not how to think. It means that people are given a certain interpretation of the truth, which is the only interpretation, and they're not allowed to think outside the box and to understand that there are usually more than one answer to any problem. That's what it means.
Okay. Going back to those countries that you've held up as examples, Tunisia, I guess we could say that that's where the Arab Spring all began. Why have you listed some amazing accomplishments in Tunisia? Why did it happen there, and a place like Egypt is still struggling, and Saudi Arabia is really struggling?
Well, there are many reasons. Tunisia is a society that is relatively homogeneous. So people think of themselves and have thought of themselves as Tunisians even long before their modern nation state was created. Mm. It's a country that does have a middle class with a high level of education. And it's a country that also maybe, unlike most other countries in the Arab world, is not dominated just by the secular elite and the religious opposition. But they do have a strong third force in the form of labor unions and a very strong civil society movement that actually has forced the other two major forces to compromise when things got to a loggerhead. And it also has an Islamist force, a Nahda, that has been more forward-looking than probably any other political Islamist force in the Middle East, one that has views that resemble a civil society more than any other political Islamist group.
We heard a lot during the events in Egypt, and I wonder how true this is in other countries in the Arab world, of Islamist forces carving out an area where they really tended to people's needs. So when it came to education, when it came to health care, many of these groups were very much in the neighborhoods taking care of basic needs, whereas those in government may be somewhat removed from those basic needs. An explanation then of perhaps the enthusiasm that some people had for Islamist groups. Is that a fair assessment, and can you find that outside Egypt?
It is a fair assessment. Islamist forces were actually forbidden from running for office in most Arab countries. And as a result, they tended to focus on service delivery to the average citizen. And as such, because one, they could, they did this very effectively. And two, because they were able to promise people things without having to put these promises to the test, having been forbidden from assuming public office, they actually were strengthened rather than weakened by their exclusion from the system. Service delivery, however, is way different than economic management and managing a whole economy. And what we have seen in the Arab world is once these Islamist forces came into power in places like Egypt and Tunisia and were not able to deliver on the economy, even though, of course, they were there only for a short period of time, The same street in Egypt, which brought them to power last year, went against them this year. And I think we're witnessing a phase in the Arab world where delivery, performance, if you will, is starting to trump ideology. In other words, whether secular forces or religious forces that adopt purely ideological stance without an accompanying socioeconomic program to deal with people's problems, these people will pay the price.
Yeah, and dealing with jobs for people too, I would imagine, huh?
Absolutely. Jobs is really becoming the real issue. This is an area, this is a region where unemployment is 14%.
Ooh.
It is double the world's average. So jobs is among the most important area to address throughout the Arab world.
Dr. Marwan Mwasher is our guest this hour. His latest book is The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism. He is vice president for studies at Carnegie, and he has had a long and very prominent history in Jordan, beginning his career as a journalist for the Jordan Times. He opened Jordan's first embassy in Israel in 95. He became Minister of Information, government spokesperson, served in Washington from 97 to 2002 as ambassador, negotiating the first free trade agreement between Jordan and the United States. Then was foreign minister, where he played a central role in developing the Arab Peace Initiative. He worked for the World Bank as well as senior vice president of external affairs. And he is with us this hour to talk about his latest book, The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism. What do you think about what he has to say? I was interested when he said if you instituted certain kinds of reforms in education and tried to move toward pluralism, this is not going to be something that will happen overnight or even in 2 years. He mentioned the figure 45 years. How do you move to more pluralist society? Do you have hopes that that will happen? Do you think there are certain countries in the Arab world, particularly like Tunisia, that are examples? We'd love to hear from you. We have yet to talk about Syria as well, the refugee problem in the area and many other issues, and the West's role in peace initiatives. Are they helpful or are they harmful? Here's our phone number. Lines are open, and we'd love to have you join the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are also on Twitter, and that is at K Dunn Show. Tomorrow during this time period, we mentioned education with Dr. Mwasher. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about education in Wisconsin and what's happened since Act 10 to people who are in the teaching profession, what's been the result of Act 10, and what's happened to schools of education. Are there fewer students going into education in Wisconsin? Tim O'Driscoll is going to join us tomorrow. He's got a real interesting background. He taught for 36 years at Arrowhead High School. He has been supervising student teachers. Anybody in secondary education, social studies, was their supervisor, so he knows about schools all over southeast Wisconsin. And he's a big baseball guy. He played baseball at UWM, was captain of the varsity team, and he's been employed by Major League Baseball for 28 years. He is the official scorekeeper for the Milwaukee Brewers. So we'll talk about education with him tomorrow during this time period. Certainly welcoming your phone calls for Dr. Marwan Mwasher. The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism is what we're talking about. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We certainly welcome your participation in this conversation with Dr. Marwan Mwasher, author of The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism. Feel free to join us at any old time you would like. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Let's talk about various efforts, and there have been many of them, either the current, you know, attempts to revive the peace process between Israel and Palestine, or whatever we have done in terms of trying to help along the democratic process in various nations in the Arab world. Has Europe been a help, would you say, or has it been a hindrance?
Probably both. I think the West on the peace process has been helpful. Unfortunately, I think we are at a situation where the incremental process that was devised 20 years ago has exhausted its possibilities. We today know what the solution looks like. It has been negotiated and renegotiated among the parties for a very long time. What remains is the political will among both sides to bring about a solution. And there, I think that the United States and the West in general can be helpful in getting the two sides to agree on a permanent solution. On the question of reform, I think that the West tended to look at the region from the prism of the Arab-Israeli conflict, and therefore those countries that advocated peaceful means to solve the conflict were deemed moderates by the West, regardless of their positions on domestic issues facing their countries. And so countries like Saudi Arabia, like Egypt, were deemed moderates only because of their position on the Arab-Israeli conflict alone, while, of course, they were not moderates when it came to the reform process. Moving forward, I think, of course, while it is very difficult to take the interests angle out of the equation, I think that the United States can help the process by supporting the process itself rather than supporting individuals and choosing winners and losers. That is a function that needs to be kept to the countries themselves. Having also said that, I would say that reform is usually, a homegrown process. It needs to evolve. And there is no transformational process in history that has unfolded in a short 2 or 3 or even 5 years. This is a generational evolution that needs to happen over time. And there is little that the international community can do beyond, help on the margins to affect a process which in the end will have to evolve indigenously.
So you're back to 45 years.
I'm back to a generation. I think Tunisia is going to take less than 45 years. Tunisia is already on the right path through a policy of inclusion. I think Syria might even take more than 45 years.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls. We'll talk more about Syria as we progress. Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. I'm enjoying the program.
Good.
And my call is rather prompted by a new book that I'm currently reading, and it's called Lawrence in Arabia, not Lawrence of Arabia. Mm-hmm. And the reason I bring that up is because in this book, it's of course obviously set during Lawrence's time in World War One, and it goes into great length talking about all the intrigues of the various powers of the world, the United States included, by the way, in the form of Standard Oil. And their maneuverings trying to outfox one another to wind up taking from the crumbling Ottoman Empire the spoils. In this case, the spoils would mean oil. And so I guess my question for the guest is, in terms of the rights and freedoms of the various populations across that part of the world, is oil a blessing or a curse?
I think first you have a very accurate reading of that book and of the intrigues that went on then. I think oil has been as much a curse as it has been a blessing. And of course the blessing is easy to explain why. But it has been a curse because of two reasons. One, it has killed the element of productivity in the Arab world. When money literally goes on the ground, merit becomes a less important value. People don't have to be as productive as they would be otherwise if there was no oil. And two, because it has promoted the notion of no taxation, no representation. So we don't, tax you, don't hold us accountable based kind of formula. Because of that, I think the Arab world, much of the Arab world, not maybe all of it, has developed patronage system, what is called in the science rent systems, rentier systems, that depend on oil, that depend on layers around the regime that receive benefits in return for their loyalty at the expense of the general population. And as long as oil continues to play that role, I think it will, in a way, hinder the cause of democracy and the evolution of merit-based systems that would be more productive and that would be fairer to the general population, that would not really prefer certain groups over others in society.
Hmm. Since you're obviously familiar with the book I mentioned, and you think that's a pretty balanced presentation, may I take this opportunity to make that a Kathleen Dunn recommendation, maybe to talk to that author? His name is Scott Anderson.
Scott Anderson, and you may do just that, Scott, and we will take it under advisement.
Snuck that one in there, didn't I? Okay.
All right.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks,
as always. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. We, as you well know, have pondered what in the world to do to help bring an end to the horrors in Syria, which seem to continue. What's the answer to ending the horrors in Syria, and why do they continue?
Unfortunately, there is no quick answer. We are faced in Syria is, one, a brutal regime that has stopped at nothing in order to survive or to stay in power, and to date, you know, more than 150,000 Syrians have been killed. More than 10 million internally or externally displaced. You're talking about more than a third, maybe 40% of the population is already internally or externally displaced. You are also talking about an opposition that has not been united, an opposition that after a few months of being peaceful has been infiltrated by outside radical forces, both on the Sunni and the Shiite factions. And both the opposition and the regime are supported by, you know, different sets of countries. Neither side can win, neither side can dominate, and therefore we are facing a brutal stalemate in which more people will be killed, unfortunately, and without any really hope for a political process which the regime has no interest in. The regime understands that any political process is going to result in its ouster from power, even if gradually. After 150,000 people killed, it is very difficult for that regime to maintain legitimacy in the country. But because it is not interested in any political process, I'm afraid that there is no political process to talk about. There is no military solution to talk about. And what we will be faced with is more of this brutal stalemate, probably for years to come.
And the refugee problem must be significant for the surrounding countries. That's a huge number of people.
It truly is unsustainable, at least for two countries, Lebanon and Jordan. Lebanon today has over 30% of its population as Syrian refugees. Jordan over 15%. This is equivalent to more than the whole population of Canada, for example, coming into the United States. It is an unsustainable situation in a situation also in both countries where the economic conditions are already bad, where resources like water are scarce. So you put that problem on top of already bad conditions, and you have a formula for instability. The two countries, of course, can also, you know, not close the doors without violating international law for these people who are fleeing from all the bloodshed that is going on in their country. But we truly are facing an unsustainable situation that I think people have no idea how to solve if the conflict goes on.
Yeah. Let's go to Jim in Madison. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi.
The reason I'm calling is to point out a book that I recently read entitled 1848. It has to do with what would be called the European Spring, where there were uprisings and attempts to liberalize and overthrow monarchs in Germany, France, Italy, and Russia to an extent. And the outcome of that after about 10 years was that there was very little change. They were looking for constitutions. They were looking for essentially a widespread vote for all the citizens. And after some initial changes, it fell back where it was. And I think your guest is astute in pointing out that it may take a generation or more to make these changes, and of course it did in Europe. That's all, that's my comment. I'll go off.
Thank you, Jim.
1848 indeed is a year that has a lot of similarities with the Arab world. It is a year in which a lot of European societies, you know, revolted against the status quo, but also a year that saw counter revolutions then come about. And as the listener rightly stated, that not much reform took place until, of course, later iterations made reform and democracy possible. And I think we are indeed facing a similar situation in the Arab world. That is why I keep saying that there is no transformational process in history that unfolded in three short years. We should not romantically expect that just because, you know, the Arab world is able to get rid of despotic rulers, we should not romantically expect that democracy will flourish overnight. It is going to take a lot of hard work and building of institutions over time that would protect democratic norms and that would move these societies to prosperity and stability. It is not going to happen, very quickly, linearly, or easily.
Thank you so much, Jim, for the call. We have lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. Dr. Marwan Mosher is the author of The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism. And he's got quite a background. He's vice president for studies now at Carnegie. He opened Jordan's first embassy in Israel. He became Minister of Information and the government spokesperson. He served as ambassador in Washington. He also was deputy prime minister responsible for reform and government performance, senior vice president of external affairs at the World Bank, also author of The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation. And we're welcoming phone calls for him. Marwan Mosher, I want to go back to the monarchy for just a moment here because I was intrigued by what you said when countries that have monarchies may be doing just a little bit better. It's 2014, and in some ways, a monarchy seems rather anachronistic. What is the role of the monarchy, and I can't just say over the whole Arab world, but why does it survive in places? And why may it be a good thing in some countries?
So in certain countries like the Gulf, it survived because of tribal background of these countries. In places like Jordan and Morocco, it survived because of the religious sort of legitimacy of the ruler having direct descendancy from Prophet Muhammad, etc. A place like Jordan, for example, the monarchy is actually a needed institution because the major ethnic groups in the country, the East Jordanians and the Palestinians, want the monarchy to be an arbiter among them. So there are different reasons why these, and of course these countries, particularly Jordan and Morocco, have had relatively more open systems than the rest of the republics in the Arab world. And so the monarchies today, ironically, are in a unique place to supervise a reform process from above, if they so wish, that would keep them at the top in the end, but of course that would evolve the institution of the monarchy in a way to open up the political space and increase participation by citizens. I think stability and success and prosperity in the future in these countries is going to depend on whether these systems understand that they cannot cling on to absolute power from now on or not. And that is what is going to decide whether, you know, in the future they will be able to maintain the stability that they enjoy today.
Hmm. We go next to Hamid in Madison. Hello, Hamid.
Good afternoon. I just like to bring into equation, I get the part about having to change a generation and to establish democracy and all those things, but I don't know how you could do that if there is not, you're not addressing the corruption in the entire religion. Obviously, you have to, adults are the one that have to teach the children, but if adults are left out of this whole equation, how in the world do you unleash the children to change the mindset and bring democracy to the region?
Indeed, corruption has been one of the areas that has unified people in their demand to address it institutionally. And whereas the Arab uprisings so far have not really articulated in a clear way what they are for in the same way that they have articulated what they are against, probably the one issue that they all agree on is the need to fight corruption institutionally. Corruption cannot be fought institutionally unless you develop a system of checks and balances in which the executive loses the dominance that it has over, political life. That is why in a place like the United States, you have a system of checks and balances where no authority is allowed to dominate other authorities. So, you know, Congress acts as a check over government. Judicial branch acts as a check on both Congress and the government, etc. Without such a system of checks and balances, corruption is bound to happen, particularly as the region undertakes economic reform, which is needed to globalize, to move the systems out of patronage systems and into interaction with the outside world. As you do this, corruption is bound to happen, but when it does, without systems of checks and balances, it can spiral out of hand, as it did in the Arab world in the last 20 years.
Hamid, thank you so much for your call. We'll take more of them in just one moment. Here's how you reach our conversation with Dr. Marwan Marshier. His book is The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number. And again, the email is talk@wpr.org. You write that hope has been resting, as it usually does, for change with a new generation, the youth who started it all in the streets. But so far, this revolutionary young generation has done a better job of defining what it is against than what it is for. That seems to be true of a lot of movements, doesn't it?
It is, and that is why my book is partly a call to arms to make the Second Arab Awakening a battle for pluralism. I think that the traditional forces in the Arab world, both secular and religious, have not been democratic forces, and I have very strong doubts whether they are able to make the move to democratic norms in their lifetime. That is why I place my hope on the new generation, not necessarily because young age is a determinant of a commitment to pluralistic norms, but because the young are not as contaminated, if you want, by the practices of their elders. And as such, being exposed to the outside world, being exposed to the internet and other ideas other than what they have been taught, both in school and in their cultures, I think you have enough of a critical mass to work with for this young generation to one day take the helm and push for democratic societies. Mm. That is not going to be an easy process, nor a quick one. This is going to be a process that will, in my view, necessarily take decades before you evolve such a culture that is truly committed to democracy at all times. But I do believe that it is possible, and I do believe that the Arab uprisings, at least, have given the Arab world the opportunity to do so, whereas there was a lid on all political space before the Arab uprisings that has really prevented ideas from coming to the surface and being debated. Now, at least, the chance to do so has been made possible by these Arab uprisings, but to take us from protests to politics And from protest to democracy is going to be a process that will take many, many decades.
Yeah. And yet, we don't know what the world will be like 20 years from now in terms of communication, or maybe even 10 years from now. You mentioned the role of the internet. Who knows what kind of communication may be around that may speed the process up, huh?
That is the hope, indeed, that we will not have to wait as the Europeans waited after 1848. Mm-hmm. And Europe basically waited more than 100 years between the first time that people protested against the status quo until the time that they achieved, you know, stability and democracy. I mean, the Berlin Wall, let's remember, only fell in 89. And even now, 25 years after it fell, some countries are doing better than others in Europe. So indeed, this is a process that takes time. And one hopes that social media, that the modern tools of technology can only expedite this process.
Yeah. Let's go back to Egypt for a moment, which is probably where the most press was, although there hasn't been much lately, but certainly the what was happening in the streets there was covered pretty widely by the U.S. press. And you talk a lot about secular forces refusing to cooperate with Islamists until they finally sided with the armed forces in deposing a democratically elected president, and then practicing the same power monopolizing behavior of which they accuse the Islamists. So no matter who's in charge, there's this tendency to monopolize your power and to not include the people who may have very radically different ideas than you do. I guess I wonder how you do that. I mean, it seems to be a natural human inclination to do that, and to do something different, which is inclusive, is hard to do, isn't it?
It is hard, but not impossible. And the Tunisians have proved that even in a country that has not known democracy, in a country such as Tunisia that actually has been a police state until the Arab uprisings, even in such a society, that it is possible for people to understand that they cannot negate each other, and that the first order of business is not competition over who rules, but rather putting in place, you know, a constitution, a bill of rights, if you will, that assures all forces a place in society. Those who do this, as the Tunisians have done, are clearly on the path to stability and prosperity. Those that have not done this, as the Egyptians have not, are clearly not on such a path. So 3 short years after the uprisings, we already have models, transition models, that we can make use of, and lessons that we can learn on what to do or not to do if we want our societies to transition to prosperity.
Mm. Well, maybe they all just need to sit down with you.
it's going to take more than one person. I think I really believe that this is a process that where civil society needs to be involved. It's a process that has to come about from the grassroots. Mm-hmm. As I said, I think the traditional forces in the Arab world are probably not likely to behave in a democratic manner, and it's going to take a push from the ground up. From people building a political constituency for democracy, if you will, that can only come from civil society and from decades of hard work.
Mm. We have an email wants your opinion on how the abruptness of the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan will affect the rest of the Arab nations.
Well, you know, I think the U.S. intervention in Iraq, frankly, has not been a helpful one. I mean, the U.S. interfered in Iraq for 3 reasons: to bring democracy to the region, to get the region rid of weapons of mass destruction, and the U.S. also argued that this was a self-financed war, that it's going to be financed from Iraq and the countries of the region. None of that happened, of course. Democracy was not brought about in Iraq. There were no weapons of mass destruction. And, of course, the war has cost conservatively about $2 trillion so far. So I think that is why I keep going back to saying that the process of reform and building democratic societies must be an indigenous process, that the outside community cannot really help by pushing it from the outside, except at the margins. withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, might look like it will create chaos in the short term, but on the other hand, it will also force people in those countries to take responsibility for their country and to do the right thing, maybe after they exhaust all other possibilities, but to finally do the right thing and adopt policies of inclusion.
And finally, let's spend some time on Israel and Palestine. Why is it that after year after year after year of one peace proposal after another, after bringing sides together and some agreements, this failure to solve the Palestinian issue, I mean, it's been going on forever. Can we use what you've been talking about, this whole model, this hour, and apply it to that issue?
Well, again, of course, both societies need to understand that they have to agree on a two-state solution that you know, satisfies the requirements for both. Frankly, the last 20 years have been spent on trying to find a solution while settlement activity meant that the status quo was not frozen on the ground. It is tantamount to two people arguing over a slice of pizza while one of them was eating it. 20 years after, you know, Palestinians are waking up to the fact that there are 500,000 plus settlers inside their territory, and that even if you arrive at a two-state solution tomorrow, it is going to be awfully difficult to implement, given the population of settlers. I think that we are approaching a situation where a two-state solution might be really something of the past. Also, given the demographics of the situation today, there are 6 million Arabs to 6 million Jews in areas under Israel's control, and if we don't arrive at a two-state solution fast, very fast, you know, we're going to face the prospect of that solution becoming obsolete and people looking for other options.
Well, what's the other option?
Well, clearly, if Palestinians cannot have their own state, then, you know, in 5, 10, 20, or 30 years, when they become a majority, they're going to demand equal rights within the state they live in, which would mean the end of Israel as a democratic and Jewish state.
And just finally, I'm interested in, you're such a man of the world. You've spent most of your life and you've been a really high public figure in Jordan. Are you just here temporarily? Do you like living here?
I am here temporarily. I'm going back permanently to Jordan this July to start also a movement on the ground. I believe that, you know, as I said, civil society organizations must take the lead in working on the ground and developing pluralistic societies, and I hope that I will be able to contribute to this process.
Whoa, what are you going to set up? That's a big thing.
it's also a difficult and tedious
right,
and long, but I think that there are no shortcuts to democracy, that if the Arab world is to develop pluralistic societies, then people must be ready to commit themselves to a long and hard process of developing such norms.
You don't do anything in a small way, do you? That's a good thing. Thank you ever so much for being with us. It was a fascinating hour. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Kathleen.
Our guest this hour, Marwan Mwasher. What a life, huh? And now he's going to do exactly what he talked about on the ground in Jordan. Vice President for Studies at Carnegie, and in that capacity he oversees research in Washington and Beirut on the Middle East. He was foreign minister from 2002 to 2004, deputy prime minister 2004 to 2005 of Jordan. He opened the first embassy in Israel in 1995, was minister of information and the government spokesperson. In 96, he's been ambassador to Washington, negotiated the first free trade agreement, deputy prime minister responsible for reform and government performance in Jordan, and led the effort to produce a 10-year plan for political, economic, and social reform. His other book, we were talking to him about his just released book, which is The Second Arab Awakening and the Battle for Pluralism. His other book is The Arab Center, The Promise of Moderation. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production in our studios right here in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow, first hour of our program, we're going to be talking about the shortage of this drug that is used in lethal injections, and also, of course, talk about that horrendous botched execution. And second hour of our program, we'll speak with a man who really considers teaching his lifetime calling, although you could say baseball is as well. Tim O'Driscoll will be joining us, taught at Arrowhead High School, chair of the social studies department for a long time, and now teaches teachers, social studies teachers. We're going to look at the teaching profession in Wisconsin, hour two of our program, and determine if teaching is still an honorable profession that is attracting many young students or not. Thanks for listening.